Migration Conversations is a podcast that invites persons to share their migration stories. Hosted by myself, Professor Jamie Liu, each episode is an in-depth conversation with people who have experienced the Canadian immigration system or other migration regimes up close. We talk to migrants, immigrants, lawyers, policymakers, advocates, and experts. We hope that these conversations shed light on the challenges migrants face through their own voices. Welcome to another episode of Migration Conversations. Today, I'm speaking with Harsha Walia. Harsha is an executive director of the BC Civil Liberties Association. She is an activist, community organizer, and popular educator known for working with migrant communities and is the co-founder of No One Is Illegal. She is the author of Undoing Border Imperialism and a co-author of Never Home, Legislating Discrimination in Canadian Immigration, as well as Red Women Rising, Indigenous Women Survivors in Vancouver's Downtown East Side. So excited, but also so humbled to be in conversation with you, Harsha. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Harsha, many of our listeners of the podcast are students and are inspired by the work you do to build community, but also are inspired by your effective advocacy work. And I wanted to ask you how you became an activist and how you became passionate about migrant justice and Indigenous solidarity.
Oh, thanks for that question. It's actually, I find that one always the hardest one to answer. And I think, I guess what I would emphasize here is, you know, there's a lot in terms of my personal history, which is likely true for many other people as well. You know, in terms of our own experiences or familial or community experiences around migration and displacement and just an understanding, in very kind of, you know, in simple and increasingly nuanced ways around just the deep inequities of the world. You know, I just even recall, I mean, there's a lot more, but even the simplest things, you know, recalling standing in separate lines for passports and visas and all those, you know, that's like the constant conversation, which is really not a reality for many people who have access to mobility around the world. And, you know, and things that are more intense than that in terms of, you know, deportation and displacement and partition and other things. But I think, so I think in that way, that's a shared experience that's not unique to me. But I think the thing that increasingly, it wasn't like a one spark moment, you know, and I also believe that that's not true for most people. I don't think we have these, like, you know, movie style blockbuster kind of aha moments in the world changes in a moment. I think it really was just increasingly being aware of what was happening around me. And, you know, I became increasingly politicized in the post 9/11 climate, which was kind of the convergence of the anti-globalization movement that predated it with Seattle and FTAA. With Quebec City and Seattle. So, you know, mass mobilizations to oppose globalization, corporate globalization as we know it. And then, you know, that very quickly morphed into the post 9/11 climate, which really saw the rise of an anti-war movement, a movement that was highlighting the ways in which racial profiling, which, you know, is just one form of systemic racism, was escalating, particularly as it came to deportations and detentions. So I became politicized in that climate. And I think, you know, for each generation, there's different movements around us that teach us, that are trying to raise awareness about, you know, the conditions of the world and the historic and ongoing conditions of violence and structural oppression. And it really is, you know, our responsibility about how we are going to engage with those conditions and how we take on our responsibilities to be part of those movements. So in that sense, it really, there's nothing spectacular about my experience. It really is, you know, personal, collective, and the conditions of the world, really.
Yeah, I really like how you've characterized it as a collective, right? That's a huge overarching theme in much of the work that you do, that you're part of a community, but also that there's a responsibility to keep learning, to keep educating yourself about the conditions that the world is in, and the different structures and the different hardships that people have endured. So I wondered if you could now turn to your seminal book, Undoing Border Imperialism, which is a great scholarly piece of writing, and I highly recommend anyone who hasn't read it to do so. There's many aspects of it I want to talk to you about, but first I wonder if you could first explain, what is border imperialism?
Sure. And thank you for the kind words about the book. To be honest, it was it wasn't intended as a scholarly work. It was more intended as a history of movements, and came out of a series that was trying to uplift that the Institute for Anarchist Studies was working on, which was, you know, trying to produce movement theory. So thank you for that. I have a new book coming out, which I hope is more rigorous in terms of theory, and spends a little bit more time thinking through some of those things.
What is it called, Harsha?
It's called Border and Rule.
Okay, well, I'll definitely keep an eye out for it.
Yeah, no worries. But in terms of, the work around undoing border imperialism, really what I was contending with, and again, you know, this isn't unique to me, this is theory that I strongly believe emerges from movement and community and practice, and I, you know, don't claim any ownership over it. But, you know, how to think about immigration through an expansive way, because so much of immigration work is really domesticated, right? Which is the idea of, you know, state control of borders, the kind of most liberal or progressive formulation one might have is about, you know, increasing the quotas, right? Like bring in more refugees, increase family sponsorship. So, but it still very much centers the state, and very much normalizes immigration as a domestic phenomenon, right? That this is domestic policy that the state controls, without really interrogating how migrants come to be, how definitions of migration have even come to be in this world. You know, state borders really are a new phenomenon. And so border imperialism was an attempt to really connect anti-imperialist theory to the ways in which we understand immigration, about how important it is to understand imperialism, both as a significant driver of displacement and migration, right, that we can't ignore these historical patterns of impoverishment and displacement and war and, you know, economic injustice and capitalism and all of these kinds of global forces that structure displacement and migration. So it was trying to really connect these kind of global forces to the ways in which we understand immigration, and also to connect immigration to other forms of structural oppression, right? So for example, you know, how does a quote unquote category of illegal get created, right? So what are the forces that create the criminalization of migration, where we suddenly label entire human beings as illegal and have divided out people into legitimate and illegitimate, legal, illegal, et cetera. So of course, this is work that, you know, radical theorists, radical organizers around immigration justice have been doing for so long. I was part of a movement called No One Is Illegal, which very much embodies and, you know, enacts that practice. And so the writing of the book was really just to kind of bring that to light to more people in our movements, and an attempt to connect the migrant justice movement to other movements who are anti-capitalist, anti-racist, and anti-imperialist.
That's fantastic. I note that, you know, as you said, when people talk about immigration law in Canada and how people experience it, many do so without acknowledging that it maintains a racialized hierarchy, right? When I think people talk about it in this vacuum of neutrality, that and assume laws and policies apply equally to everybody. And I wondered if you can explain the project of undoing border imperialism then, and what does it look like, you know, given that you've outlined the fact that there is a history, there are historical patterns, as you put it, and you know how it is connected to the wider project of colonialism and imperialism, and what needs to be done to, instead of just looking purely at the law or purely at certain kinds of experiences, rather than perhaps the experience through a racialized or critical race lens.
Yeah, I think you know, that's where, again, that kind of expansive understanding and those connections to more, you know, to broader systemic forces becomes really key. I mean, you know, as Cedric Robinson and Robin Kelly would remind us, there is no capitalism that's not racial. So for example, when we're thinking through the displacement of people as a result of racial capitalism, you know, free trade agreements, corporate violence, you know, Canada is home to 75% of the world's mining companies who wreak havoc around the world, right? Around South and Central America, around Africa, around Asia. You know, and so people are displaced as a result of racial capitalism and economic violence that Canada is very much complicit in. Imperialism and occupation are, of course, deeply racialized and racist projects, right? So, you know, again, turning back to the kind of post-9/11, the immediacy of the post-9/11 climate, the entire war on terror is a racist project, but, you know, specifically, of course, it was heightened in the post-9/11 climate, where not only were people increasingly subject to racist surveillance within Canada, so particularly Muslims, South Asians, Black Muslims, Arabs, et cetera, increasingly subject to scrutiny. And, you know, that kind of guilty by association kind of rhetoric, and also policies that became entrenched, right? So Canada Border Services Agency did not exist prior to 9/11. It's a completely new agency. You know, anti-terror laws, all of these became state-sanctioned racist violence. And at the same time, in the kind of global sphere, the war on terror took the form of course, you know, military occupation, drone warfare, the kind of weaponization of feminism. You know, the idea that the occupation of Afghanistan was somehow to liberate Afghan Muslim women from the Taliban, right? A deeply imperialist, racist kind of agenda, really Orientalist, to draw, of course, on Edward Said. And so, you know, these kinds of ways in which racism is so embedded in immigration is part and parcel of looking at this through the global lens. Because again, when we think about what creates displacement, racialized hierarchies is very much a part of that, right? The who is the other, who is the global South, who is the so-called third world, et cetera. And then the ways in which the quote unquote third world that manifests within borders becomes subjected to violence. And I think one of the most kind of salient examples of this, there are many that, you know, inhibit people's lived experiences. But I think the most salient one is that even in, so I live in BC in the West Coast on unceded Coast Salish territories on the lands of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish people. And here in these territories, if you asked anybody, you know, who are illegal immigrants, right? Most people would right away think of the kind of stereotypes of, you know, Mexican migrant workers, or, you know, all the kinds of stereotypes that come into people's minds. But rarely do people ever think of, you know, Americans who've overstayed their visas, or in particular to the part of the region that I live in, there's tons of Australians who overstay their visas and work in the ski resort industries. You know, many of whom are quote unquote illegal, i.e. not authorized by the law to remain, either because they have overstayed visas or they are working on visitor permits, which you're technically not allowed to do, right? So, and if those stories ever do come to light in the media, they're portrayed with such empathy, right? Like, oh, look at our awful bureaucracy, just, you know, impeding the progress of young students who are contributing so much, you know, it's sown with much sympathy and empathy. However, of course, it's a drastically different story when we're talking about the deportation and detention of racialized people. And even more so, of course, you know, if they're Black folks, right? The ways in which anti-Blackness is such a key part of that. And so, you know, those are just such clear ways, and there's so many others, those are such clear ways in which the racialization of immigration is, as you said, it's not about neutrality or the law, right? How we understand the law is underwritten by all of these systemic forces, and how we use the law, who is, you know, who's protected by the law, who's criminalized by the law, And even in the kind of social ways, you know, who's constructed as illegal under the law is completely underwritten by race.
Yeah, I think it's very important to, from what I'm getting from what your work has taught me, is that there has to be a bit of understanding about where these structures have come from, you know, what they were used historically, what they continue to do today under the guise of neutrality in law. But there are tons of people who I think have a kind of deferential or even a defensive attitude towards this idea of open borders or undoing borders. And, you know, critics of the open borders movement will say it's impractical, it's unrealistic, it's impossible in today's global environment. What do you say to them when you're confronted with these people who just cannot imagine or cannot move past that kind of framework?
Yeah, I think I'd say a few things, depending on who they are, I guess. I think that, you know, I think there's a few things that are important corollaries to the open borders movement, right? The one corollary to kind of the freedom to move and open borders is also to fight for the freedom to stay. And so I think it is important that open borders movement does tackle the roots of why people are moving and ensure that people aren't being displaced, right? And so I think the freedom to stay and the freedom to move are kind of intertwined. And it is necessary to advocate for the freedom to move alongside the freedom to stay, not for the kind of racist reasons about we'll be overrun by people, therefore people shouldn't move, but fundamentally because people should not be forcibly displaced. And people have a right to remain in their homes, have a right to be with their families, have a right to livelihood in other, you know, in all places of the world. And so I do think that that is necessary. And that is also part of, you know, racial justice work, which is to fight forced displacement. And it is also part of justice work to fight for people to have the ability to move, either because the conditions of the world are so violent that they need to move, or because they choose to move in the sense of, you know, move for love, move for family. You know, so I think that's one necessary part about an open borders movement. I think the other necessary part of an open borders movement is that it cannot simply be symbolic, right? It's not about opening the border, because the border is not a single site. The border exists in so many different ways. And again, you know, a border is a symptom of a racial social organization and racial social violence that we have to make sure that we are dismantling as well. So it's not enough to say open the borders, but let people come in, for example, as indentured workers under migrant worker programs, right? Because those are also a form of bordering incarcerality, right? It's a form of incarceration, literally, where your passports are confiscated, you're on curfew for many low-wage migrant workers. It's also not enough to say, you know, open the borders while we're not then tending to the ways in which the lives of racialized people, particularly Black and Indigenous people, is organized within the nation state, right? So I think open borders movement also, in some parts of the world, I think, you know, it hasn't even really caught on in Canada, so it's moot. But, you know, say in Europe, where open borders movements are really strong, which is important, but it's also really important to tend to, you know, racial social organization and racial social violence. And not to cling to the border as like a site, right? And so I think those two are things that I would say more to, you know, folks in the movement who are sympathetic to open borders movement, which is not the question, but I did want to say that. And then to, you know, others who are just reticent around the open borders movement, I think it is just so important to understand that this is already the reality. People are already on the move. And refusing people the right to movement really is, it's a death sentence, right? People are dying. And it's not a passive act. People are being killed by border imperialism. Borders kill. You know, whether it's the Sonoran Desert, whether it's the Mediterranean, whether it's the Safe Third Country Agreement, and people, you know, who have died trying to cross through from the United States to Canada, you know, whether it's the deathscape of what's happening in Libya, you know, in Australia and Woomera, just all around the world. And of course, with, you know, climate catastrophe, this is only increasing and exacerbating. And it is completely within the state's interest, as we have seen, to clamp down on borders and to reframe the kind of crisis of displacement and immobility as like a refugee crisis, right? As if the refugees or migrants are creating the crisis rather than states themselves. This is something that states have responsibility for, and states absolutely can be the solution for, which is an oxymoron. But really it's not, you know, the onus is not on migrants and refugees to not move given the conditions of violence in the world. And so for people who don't believe that, I think, most of the stereotypes or the reasons or justifications we're given for it simply kind of don't hold up. You know, this idea that, our economy will get drained, all of these kinds of things. And it's like, well, no, the reality is the economy will always rely on migrant labor. The question is under what conditions, right? It's not as if though immigrants and migrant workers and undocumented workers aren't already here. Opening the borders simply means that they're, you know, given the conditions of safety, permanent residence, unionization, labor standards, health standards, that those become the conditions under their arrival, right? So open the borders doesn't suddenly mean that we go from no migrants to thousands of migrants. Migrants are already here. We know that, you know, most people who are migrants in the context of Canada are on temporary permits. And then I think it's also, you know, the other kind of stereotype is the idea about, you know, well, what'll happen to our culture, which are really just racist code, right? For like, what do you mean by our culture?
Exactly. It's always evolving. And I mean, Canada kind of puts itself on the multicultural pedestal, but at the same time, they...
Yeah. And at the same time is, you know, so worried about basically maintaining white supremacy and white hegemony, right? And then a kind of third kind of argument that I think we hear a lot is, well, what'll happen about our resources? So things like the welfare state, you know, what'll happen to healthcare, et cetera. And we know for a fact that that's a matter of political priorities, right? Like we have, you know, Trump is in the news right now about not paying taxes. We know Canadian companies didn't pay $51 billion worth of taxes in a single year. You know, we know that we sink money into the police and the military, right? So they're absolutely, you know, that kind of austerity logic is something we also have to refuse, which is the idea that there isn't enough, because absolutely there is enough when it comes to the welfare state. It's just the fact that our governments have chosen to kind of completely drain out social services when it comes to healthcare, childcare, education, at the expense of corporate bailouts and subsidizing the fossil fuel industry, and putting money into the police and the military, right? Those are arms of the state that continue to get resources and border services and CBSA. And so, you know, that kind of austerity logic doesn't help anybody. And really, I think, you know, for working class Canadians who think that the wage floor will get dropped, right? This idea that if a bunch of workers come in, we won't be able to build robust unions, that workers will be competing for well-paying union jobs. I think it's really important to remember what drops the wage floor for working class workers is temporary migrant labor, right? So if everyone is able to come with full rights to unionization, then the wage floor is actually more secure. The border acts as a fix for capital accumulation, right? The border doesn't protect the working class. It just segments the labor force and creates a class of so-called third world workers. And so really for, you know, working class people who are so worried and who have bought into the logic that the border protects labor, it really doesn't. The border is precisely what guts the power of workers and the power of the working class.
That I am amazed at how much you packed in just 10 minutes of explaining that and taking down every critique that has been thrown towards the open borders movement. That was impressive. I have to say that, you know, a lot of this work has kind of reinforce some of the work that I'm doing on stateless persons, how you've talked about, you know, the blame is always put on the person that they haven't done enough work, that they didn't get their documentation, they didn't register themselves, but really it's the state that's constructing that figure. And more and more, the more and more I dig into the issue of statelessness, the more it has become very apparent to me that it is due to a very deliberate state action to exclude people. And to exclude people based on a racialized hierarchy. So this is so helpful for even just my thinking, just listening to you express the work that you've been doing for decades. I also thought your book was a testament to the collaborative nature of community activism. You embed within the book awesome works by other people, poetry, artwork, contributions from other advocates and activists. And I wondered if you could tell me the importance of community in the work that you do, in the work of mobilizing movements, and what it means to be a good community member. What should we be telling, you know, young people who want to be more involved and want to be a good community member?
Yeah, I think for me, absolutely, what was for me really the heart of the book was a chapter in the book that's a roundtable, which is, you know, different organizers talking about their experiences, and also, you know, kind of weaving through people's poetry and stories and vignettes and other things. And for me, that really was both, you know, a personal, but even more so a political decision. I really struggled with writing the book. You know, it took me like, I think 6 months to a year to agree to write it and 6 weeks to actually write it, because I really struggled more with the ethical decision around writing the book. And the idea, right, of what happens when one writes a book and, you know, gets kind of credit, which is makes more sense in some contexts, makes less sense in a movement context, right, where I'm writing a book about a movement that I'm simply one person that's contributed to it. So I just really wanted to ensure that this book didn't get kind of lifted up as like the history of No One Is Legal as written by me, and that there was as much room as possible for others, including, you know, dissension and debate and just different ideas around how we understand that movement to have taken shape over, you know, over 10 years. And so for me, that was a really important decision, because, you know, movements come and go, but their histories tend to be written by a few people. So I wanted as much as possible for it to be written by as many people as possible, to recognize that labor and that time. And really for me to emphasize what I deeply believe to be true, which is that there is no liberation in isolation, right? That the way that we make freedom and the way that we envision freedom necessarily includes our work with people. That is what this is fundamentally all about, right? And so it's not about just my ideas, it's about the relationships that are part of the movement. And so, you know, for me, the idea of being a good community member, it's a hard one, you know, because community is also at the same time such an amorphous word. It's can be deeply romanticized and at the same time can be troubled and deconstructed and all of those kinds of things. I think there's a few things around being a good community member that are not prescriptive. They're just, you know, thoughts and ideas. You know, one is I think it is important to be clear on one's politics, because communities can have very diverse ideas. And I think it's important to be open to different ideas, but to be clear about where one stands on the political terrain. Because I think, you know, something that can happen, for example, is to identify community with, say, one's identity, right? And so however one chooses to identify, there will absolutely be people on the right wing of that spectrum. So are those part of our community, right? So a good community member, I think, are folks who are connected to people, are connected and aware of, you know, who is the most marginalized by systems of oppression, and kind of takes those experiences into account, has a clear sense of politics. Like, I don't think it's enough to say, you know, I'm listening to X community, because X community is very diverse and that can become a form of tokenism. And I think it really is just to continue to learn, to be in relationship. You know, I truly believe that there are no answers that are a given, well, other than revolution, but, you know, conditions are shifting, and we have to keep adapting our relationships and our work. And I think for me, the main kind of guiding principle, is one that I hear often, in various Indigenous communities, and, you know, not in a pan-Indigenous way, again, that's tokenistic, but in different Indigenous communities, is the idea of being a good ancestor, right? So how do we be, for me, being a good community member is being a good ancestor. And, you know, how to think in terms of generations forward. And for those of us who have intergenerational lives, whether we're caring for children or caring for elders in our lives, I think that grounds us a little bit in that principle, right? Which is, how do we leave the earth in a better way?
Yeah, you know what, I actually found some pieces in your book very reaffirming, as someone who was raised in a non-Western kind of upbringing, this kind of idea of community. And you kind of talk about self-care as being something that, you know, is a very individualistic thing, and that you kind of advocate for a more collective kind of approach to well-being, right? And recognizing that self-care is dependent on other things, right? You can't do anything in isolation, as you said. And I found it really powerful how you've tied the collective idea and the strength in that, in terms of recognizing that our actions affect so many people, and that we have to be cognizant of that, and cognizant of not only the people that are our elders or people who are no longer with us, but also the people that we're raising, right? Yeah, it's a very powerful aspect of your book. I wondered if you could talk about your time as executive director of the BCCLA. I know you started this fairly recently, and then the pandemic hit. And I wanted to ask how this role both has challenged you in your work, but also allowed you to further the causes that you feel are important to you and the communities that you are part of.
Well, I don't know if it's furthered the work yet. That's my existential crisis question in this new job, to be honest. I don't know yet. I don't know, but you know, the BCCLA is an amazing organization, as you know, the kind of oldest civil liberties organization in the country. I've always kind of had a deep respect, and I'm excited to be part of an organization that is, you know, just frankly not afraid to litigate. And as an organizer, you know, sometimes, I mean, I very strongly believe that the power of movements rests outside systems. And I think litigation is a useful tactic, right? Because it's very tiring to watch most NGOs just simply kind of lobby and try to placate the state and placate governments. And, you know, the idea that sitting at the table is going to somehow get you what you want. I just don't believe that that is possible. And I believe when that does happen, it's because of the power of movements, not because of the power of some backroom lobby. And so the thing that I think is quite powerful about organizations like the BCCLA is the ways in which they can offer strength to movements through legal skills, right? And through the ability to litigate injustices. And so that's something that I think is so powerful and needed. And for, you know, it's just such a formidable combination, right? To be able to have community groups who are fighting on the ground to be supported in the courts. So, you know, that's the dream.
Well, I have to say, when they announced that you became executive director, I was like, wow, BCCLA has upped its game. I'm like, welcome. So it's great. And I wanted to ask, you know, now that you're in this role, you know, we're talking mainly to young people, but I just wanted your sense or your opinion of where our focus should be. What should we pay attention to? Where should our fighting energy be directed for future lawyers? What advice do you have for people who are going to be working in the legal systems in Canada? How do we continue to be resistors, even though we might be embedded in the very institutions or systems that we are in conflict with sometimes?
Yeah. I think the main thing is really do what you're good at and do what you like, because the thing is, the movement just can't move ahead with folks feeling like we're martyrs, right? Where we're doing things that we're all going to do things we don't like, to that point of self-care. Sometimes you have to step up and do things in order to support other people. But I mean, I don't mean that in that moment to moment. I mean, in that overall sense, for people who are called to the law, it is so necessary to practice the law or teach the law or be involved in research, whatever that looks like. For people who aren't feeling it, feel free to walk away, right? There are other paths, even if you got that education, to not have to practice the law. But I think the main thing is to really hone in on your skill set and to not think that there's only one kind of skill that's needed, right? I really think that there are so many things that are needed. The question is how to make that relevant to communities. And there are communities who are, you know, looking for litigators, who are looking for researchers, who are looking for support around Know Your Rights, who are looking for people to do legal defense. So I don't think that there's ever not a possibility to be involved. I think it's just about finding connection and finding one's strengths.
Yeah, and I wondered if you could comment on anything that you are particularly focusing on these days, or something that is bothering you or something we should be kind of aware of that hasn't reached maybe public mainstream radar? I know there's been a lot of
everything.
Work. I know it's COVID. Everything's kind of blown up during the pandemic. And I feel everything. Like it's really hard.
I don't think there's anything that's not known truly, right? I mean, I think if anything, it's really encouraging that the interconnections around systems of violence are things that we're increasingly attuned to, right? The ways in which detention is connected to prisons, is connected to police, is connected to arbitrary laws and legal systems. I don't think this is something that we don't know, but I do think that it's neat that, you know, it's important for us to generally be more thoughtful about how things are playing out in an internationalist sense. Like, I think we are very nationalistic and domesticated, and, you know, so is the US. And if we know anything, it's about the US, and maybe that's about it. But I think it is so important to look at the ways in which systems are being exported across jurisdictions. And I don't think there's a lot of that or enough of that. But I mean, that for me was the impetus to write another book, was just trying to think about the ways in which systems are shared across jurisdictions, and to look at the connections. And I think especially in Canada, we think that we inherit, you know, US systems, and we haven't thought about the ways in which we've actually perfected violence in the Canadian context and actually exported it out. But I think there's so much to be learned around the ways in which states share structures of violence, and to learn those lessons from other contexts.
Harsha, I have to say, I'm really delighted to have met you, and I'm in awe of the energy you bring to everything. If I can ask just one final question, how do you maintain energy, positivity, and hope despite the challenges in front of us? How do you keep the good fight going? How do you keep up with everything that's going on? It's quite an amazing feat, I have to say.
Thank you. I think so many folks are doing this in so many different ways. I think for me, hope really is in like a lot of the seemingly smaller invisible victories. You know, so the state is, you know, grinding violence, capitalism is grinding violence, but, you know, anytime that we can fight to stop a deportation, fight to stop a detention, or even just to break isolation, right? A lot of people feel so much fear and overwhelm, and just to be able to make connections with people so they don't feel so alone. For me, really is hopeful, right? Because ultimately, it is those social bonds over time that create the conditions for transformation and revolutionary change. And that is so hard to do because we are increasingly in an isolationist world, even more so in COVID. That, you know, maintaining social connection seems like a very low bar. But I think it's important to remember that there are so many small victories. And part of it is, that is the thing, like the being involved in struggle and doing things with other people is a self-generating force, right? It's really hard to feel that sense of hope outside of those relations and connections, because otherwise it's completely overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. I think that's right. And I think it's more important than ever to reach out to people, to check in on them, to provide support, and not to be afraid to ask for that yourself too, amongst other people, and to recognize people who are vulnerable, and to be compassionate, and remember to be kind to one another. Harsha, I'm so delighted that you were able to join us, and thank you again for your precious time.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Migration Conversations is created and hosted by me, Professor Jamie Liu, and produced by University of Ottawa Tech Law Fellow June Gleed. This podcast was made possible with the guidance and assistance of University of Ottawa Tech Law Fellow Ritesh Kotak, Carleton University graduate student Rachel McNally, as well as the generous support of Carleton University and the University of Ottawa Shared Online Projects Initiatives. You can find more Migration Conversations episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and YouTube with closed captions. Thank you for listening, and a special thank you for all the guests who have shared their experiences publicly.